All right. So, we left off talking about the incremental expansion of power by the federal government over the states and, of course, the municipalities. And again, this was done post-Civil War, after the states' rights movement was dealt a huge blow, and it wasn't done all at once. It was incremental. It would go this way, and this way, and this way, and this way. And again, we gave you some examples. Law enforcement, banking. They got involved in elections, property rights. Things that the original drafters of the Constitution would have never envisioned. Because the Founding Fathers, like them or not, they envisioned a system where the people would be able to have the most influence over the local government. And that should be the level of government that had the most power over individuals. And then, of course, above that was the states. But again, people would still have an influence because they could control their towns, which would control the states. But of course, as a result of 100 plus years of history, by the beginning of the 20th century, the Venn diagram was not only flipped on its side, but the layers began to squish together. Communications, food, drugs, parks, going after businesses, things that were not part of the original plan, but things that were slowly developing. But by the Progressive Era, 1890s, going into the 20th century, the federal government did not want to provoke another civil war, did not want to provoke resistance. So how do you prevent the states from firing back? You bribe them. You give them money. There is an old maxim, which is so true. With money comes control. Simultaneous to the exponential increase in power, regulations, rules, the federal government ensured compliance by giving the states money. And the form of grants came in areas where the states did not have the means to fund. Think about it. With the invention of the automobile, who's going to pay for the roads? If you have times of population growth, you need more food. So let's give grants to farmers so they can buy more land and produce more food. Things like that. Things that, again, are not expressly listed in the Constitution. But politicians decided, hey, if I do this, it will make me more popular and I'll get reelected. But all the way up until the McKinley era, government only had so much money. The primary revenue stream was from tariffs. And by the way, there was no deficit. The government took in enough money to spend and provide for the services that it was funding. But if it wanted to provide more, it needed more money. So the progressives began scratching their head and thinking, where can we get more money from? I know. Let's take it from the American people. So the progressives would push, propose, and ratify the 16th Amendment. Does anyone know what the 16th Amendment allows the government to do?
this is the most powerful, controlling, intrusive of all of the constitutional amendments. Nobody knows 16th Amendment?
Levying
what taxes and stuff. What taxes? Taxes on what?
Like, is that like bank
money? No.
Is it imported goods?
No. What do you get if you have a job every single week? Oh, the federal government decided the American people were making so much money, let's tax the American people directly. The 16th Amendment paved the way for a direct tax on income. This is the reason why, before you actually get a single penny from your boss, the government gets its cut first. Now, by the way, on the exam, I asked, what was the amendment process? And why did it occur? Well, of course, an amendment rises whenever there's a big issue, big enough that it convinces Congress and the states to change the Constitution itself. And once the Constitution is changed, that is the rule of law. So the Supreme Court can't stop an amendment, but the moment the Constitution's amended, the Supreme Court must enforce situations under the amendment. Why do I mention that? Well, 20 years before the 16th Amendment was passed, a case actually got up to the Supreme Court when the progressives tried passing a law through Congress that created an income tax. It would have been a 2% income tax on those who made more than $4,000 a year, which at the time was like the top 20% of wage earners. So they went to go tax the rich. Well, the Supreme Court turned around and said it was unconstitutional. Because the original Constitution, prior to the 16th Amendment, prevented the federal government from taxing the people directly. So because of that Supreme Court ruling, the progressive acted, changed the Constitution, and the income tax would be passed. And what did the government do with all that money? More grants. Because with money comes control. But the national government didn't attempt to destroy the states, to eliminate the states. But rather, the federal government, using its money, became like the puppet master, who use the money to get the states to bend to DC's will. And, by the way, the states also began to grow. So, for instance, Massachusetts, because of the 16th Amendment, Massachusetts passed a state income tax law. Where also did the states grow state power over people? They started imposing standards and rules and requirements for education that would give rise to the modern K-12 system. Not too long ago, everyone in a town went to a single schoolhouse, and you had kids from 10 to 18 all in the same room. Well, now you had to have these new buildings. You had to separate them based on age. You had to put in standards set by the state. Well, if a town couldn't afford to build a new school, guess where they get the money from? They got it from the state. Who got the money from the federal government? It also pushed for welfare programs.
water, sewerage, hospitals, police, fire, sanitation. All of these things would be programs implemented by the states, but funded in part with federal money. And by the way, the federal government set the standards. What is a fire department? What must a town do to qualify to have a fire department? What rules do they have to follow? All of it was attached with money, grants, funding mechanisms. And the states went along with it. But, in terms of our checks and balances, the SCOTUS did allow some growth, but other areas, they struck growth down, declaring it to be unconstitutional. So, the Supreme Court allowed the federal government to create the FBI. The Supreme Court allowed the federal government to create the reserve banking system. But what about child labor? During the Woodrow Wilson administration, Congress passed a law that made it illegal to employ children in interstate commerce. Because I hate to break it to you, if you were alive 100 years ago, you would not be here. Chances are you'd be working alongside mom and dad at a factory. Why? Because mom and dad actually needed the extra money. Well, a business challenged the law, gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, and in 1918, in the case Hammer v. Dagenhart, the Supreme Court declared a congressional ban on child labor as unconstitutional. Unconstitutional. The court's reasoning? How can you be sure that every product that's made by a child actually goes to interstate commerce? What about those that are sold intrastate, which is beyond the regulation of Congress? So the Supreme Court said, too bad, kids can still work. What about minimum wages? Well, also in the Woodrow Wilson administration, Congress passed a law establishing a minimum wage for women and children working in the District of Columbia. It was going to be a test law to try to impose a minimum wage on the country. Well, case gets up to the Supreme Court. Atkins v. Children's Hospital. And the Supreme Court struck down minimum wage as unconstitutional. Because it's a violation of the Contracts Clause. You make a contract with your employer. The employer promises to pay you a wage determined by the employer. And you have a choice. Do I take the job or not? And if you take the job, you take what you get paid. So, no child labor laws, no minimum wages. And what about unions? Well, the Supreme Court also declared that unions were unconstitutional. During the Teddy Roosevelt administration, a law was passed that prohibited what were known as yellow dog contracts. Yellow dog contracts. A yellow dog contract was a contract which, in the terms, the signer promised not to join a union or they would be fired. Well, Congress passed a law that said, no, that's illegal. Well, in 1908, in the case Adair v. United States, the Supreme Court struck down that law. Again, the terms of the contract are determined by the employer and the employee. Federal government has no right to interfere because you don't have a right to unionize. So the progressives tried, but the Supreme Court stepped in some areas and said no. So, how do you eliminate that roadblock if you are a progressive and you want to push your progressive legislation? Well, simple. You change the court. The progressive era, the marble layer cake, where the deliciousness starts oozing into the layers, would swiftly be replaced, or rather would evolve, into what became known as the marble cake version of federalism, or more precisely, the cooperative model of federalism. Cooperative federalism involves a system where society expects federal, state, and local all to work together, cooperatively, in regulating the private sector. So, no more divisions. Everything is just delicious marble cake. We get a little bit of the white cake or the yellow cake blended deliciously with the chocolate cake. And in every scrumptious bite, you get a little bit of both. Well, coincidentally, what paved the way for this was the Great Depression. Beginning with Black Friday, the sudden Wall Street crash, our economy went literally into the toilet. Unemployment skyrocketed to 25%. The market lost 75% of its value. Millions of Americans lost their homes, they lost their farms, they lost their businesses. Why? Well, you have to take a look at what happened in the 1920s. In World War I, we became the world's bank. But by the end of the decade, the Europeans basically stopped paying us back. Plus, our industries switched over to wartime production because Europe was too busy killing itself on the trenches of Western Europe or on the vast expanse of Eastern Europe. So our factories went into overdrive, producing, producing, producing. Well, when the war came to an end, you didn't need that production. But the factory owners never throttled it back. Farmers put themselves into debt to buy more land to feed Europe. By
by the middle of the 1920s, the Europe's, because war was over, they started farming again. And they stopped buying American products. So our country put itself into debt to pay for World War I. And then when the war was over, we had all of this supply, but no one was buying, no demand. That is a very simple reason why the Great Depression occurred.
Well, because it was so bad, because people were freaking out, this was a perfect opportunity for the progressives to transform America into a socialist paradise.
The architect was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he put forward what became known as the New Deal.
He wanted to empower the federal government to control all aspects of our economy and our society. From regulating industry, controlling the stock market, controlling agriculture, on and on and on, to have the federal government in all aspects of our lives.
Well, the problem was, there were enough people that were desperate. They wanted this. They needed help.
Although the funny thing is if you actually look at modern analysis of all the stuff that FDR did, modern economists universally agree that all of what he did only perpetuated the Depression and made it worse. Why? Because he made everything more expensive with government intrusion. Even though the Supreme Court declared minimum wage to be unconstitutional, he got it through Congress. Even though the Supreme Court had ruled unionization was not legal, he pushed laws that got it through Congress.
Even though the Supreme Court had declared regulation or prohibition of child labor to be unconstitutional, he pushed laws through Congress. He ignored the checks and balances, and he did what he wanted to do.
So if FDR perpetuated, through his policies and actions, perpetuated the Great Depression, what set of factors actually contributed to getting us out of it?
World War II. Because all of the unemployed people suddenly had a job. Put a uniform on and go overseas.
They also had the federal government come into the factories and began regulating labor conditions.
The federal government would seize control of agricultural production. They passed Social Security, which allowed for federal money to go to people who did not work. And they increased all aspects of interstate regulation. Law after law after law after law after law. Executive order after executive order after executive order. You think Trump has been working overtime? Go back and look how quickly, how totality, or with a sweeping scale, that FDR moved. But here's the funny thing. The Supreme Court immediately went to work and began pushing back, pointing out that these initiatives are unconstitutional. The federal government has no authority to do this stuff. The most severe blow, slap, to FDR came on May 27th, 1935. When in one single day, Chief Justice Hughes purposely arranged for three major decisions to be read from the bench. In one day, The court ruled that the president could not fire the head of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, because the Federal Trade Commissioner refused to enact FDR's policies, arguing that it was unconstitutional. So FDR was mad, fired him. Supreme Court said you can't. Congress passed a law that made it illegal for banks to foreclose on farms if the farmer stopped paying his mortgage. Supreme Court said no, Congress can't do that. And the biggest blow was when the Supreme Court declared that the National Industrial Recovery Act, which would allow the federal government to go in factories and set quotas on what could be produced on any given day. So the federal government would come in, if you owned a business, they would tell you what you could make. Well, that was declared unconstitutional. Blow to blow after blow. The president was livid. Oh, by the way, the Supreme Court was unanimous in all of these decisions. So it wasn't like a 5-4. It wasn't like, ooh, it was a close call. No. All of the justices were together saying, this is beyond the power allowed to the federal government by the Constitution. So if you can't change the rules to the game and you want to get your outcome, what do you do?
Finesse the rules?
No, you can't change the rules.
So you're engaged in a sporting contest. The rules are the rules are. But you don't like the way the game's going. What can you change?
You can always cheat.
No, you can't cheat. You can cheat. What? You change the refs.
And by the way, this is what President Biden and the Democrats were doing or suggesting. In reaction to the Supreme Court telling the administration, you cannot do this, FDR proposed what became known as the court packing bill. Technically, it was called the Judicial Procedures Reform Bill. There were 9 justices on the Supreme Court in the 1930s. And there had been 9 justices since the 1850s. So what FDR proposed was a way to get the conservatives out of power on the court. He argued that for every sitting justice over the age of 70 and a half years, he, as president, would have the power to nominate one additional judge. Because these old men, they don't know what they're doing. Up to a maximum of 6. Thus, creating a Supreme Court of 15 judges. Why 6? Very simple. At the time, the ideological makeup of the court was 7 conservatives and 2
new dealers. Two judges that FDR put on early in his first term. By adding six, do you think the president is going to pick conservative judges? Hell no. Oh, and coincidentally, five of these and one of these are over 70 and a half. So what he proposes is because there's six guys that are that old, we'll put six New Deal justices in. And then suddenly, instead of losing, ideologically, I will now win 8-7. By the way, this is exactly what Joe Biden wanted to do, because the current makeup of the Supreme Court is, generally speaking, 6-3. Well, here's the thing. This decision was so controversial, so blatantly political, and thus antithetical to our constitutional system. Because you're not supposed to play politics. You're supposed to serve the common good. That even the Democrat Speaker of the House told FDR, I am not going to allow this bill to be put on the House floor for consideration. It was so radical, even the Democrats back then refused to do this. Because, think of the precedent. Every single time the Supreme Court rules the way you don't like, you're gonna change it. You're gonna change it. You're gonna change it. You're gonna change it. Where's the continuity? Where's the consistency? Where's the stability? You would make one of the most powerful branches in our system a political creature. So what happened? Well, this was a proverbial shot fired across the bow of the Supreme Court. Five of the justices were so horrified by what the president was proposing, they decided to retire just to preserve the court. Plus two died.
So by 1941, FDR was able to put in seven new justices. All left-wing, all progressive, all new dealers. He changed the court. Yes.
So if how would them retiring preserve the integrity of the court?
Because the nine would stay. This wouldn't allow the president to pass a law that allowed the president to change it whenever they wanted to. Because what does the Constitution say? When there's a vacancy, the president has a right to nominate with the advice and consent of the Senate. Not let's just randomly pick however many people are going to be on the bench based upon what's going on today. With this new set of refs, beginning in 1937, FDR did not lose another progressive debate. And by the way, the court would stay left-leaning all the way up until the 1990s. So, literally, the Supreme Court took a knee. And they allowed the federal government to incrementally expand and broaden its powers. Soon, the states began imposing minimum wages. Soon, laws were passed assuring the right to unionize. Child labor was prohibited. OSHA was created. And the federal government started imposing working conditions.
all enforceable in the federal courts.
So yes, you have a little mom and pop variety store on the corner somewhere in the city. The federal government has a right to come in and tell you what you must do to do your business and can punish you if you don't. And for decades, the Supreme Court upheld these decisions. Most of the decisions were upheld based on Congress's right to regulate interstate commerce. And how did the court justify it? Well, beginning with the emergence of the New Deal court, the court began adhering to a judicial philosophy known as the preemption doctrine. The preemption doctrine is based on the Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Clause 2. Article 6, Clause 2, the Supremacy Clause. Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution, it states, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, in all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land."
In other words, they stopped looking at the specific articles, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, 2, 3, to see if the government can actually do these things. Instead, the court pretty much said, well, if Congress passes a law, it's supreme. Not, can they pass the law? Does the Constitution give Congress to pass the law? No. It's simply, Congress passed the law, so it's okay.
So what did this mean? Well, the federal government can pretty much do whatever it wants and the courts can uphold it.
Now, was there judicial precedent?
Kind of. Gibbons v. Ogden. Isn't that not what John Marshall did? John Marshall and Gibbons v. Ogden made the determination that a contract for shipping lanes given by the federal government was higher than the states.
Well, now this means any law that Congress passes, it's going to be higher than the states. The states cannot say no.
What if a conflict arises? In 1992, a case gets up to the Supreme Court. Gade v. National Solid Waste Management Association. New Jersey passed a law that said nuclear waste cannot pass through the sovereign state of New Jersey without the company getting a permit from New Jersey.
Well, back in the 90s, we still had several nuclear power plants that were in operation. We still have some, but not as many as we used to. And the federal government wanted to take all of that waste and send it to the Yucca Mountain, which is this vast underground labyrinth in which we've been dumping our nuclear waste for decades. Well, there was two nuclear factories in Massachusetts. Actually, no, one was in New Hampshire. One was in Seabrook, one was in Plymouth. Well, all of that waste would be put on a train and shipped down, heading toward Arizona, and it would go through New Jersey.
Well, New Jersey said no.
case gets all the way up to the Supreme Court.
New Jersey argues that we have a fundamental right to license all commercial activity within the borders of our state. And the Supreme Court said, too bad.
Too bad. It's a national situation. It's in the interest of the country that nuclear waste and chemicals goes through your state. So you cannot protect your own residents. So,
wherever there's a situation where there's a conflict between state and federal law or under the preemption doctrine, the federal government will always win, whether or not it's actually constitutional.
Questions? So imagine how many Supreme Court cases there are a year. Typically about 100. And the Supreme Court cases the results of thousands of appeals that happen across the country. From 1937 until 1995, the Supreme Court not once, found a federal law dealing with commerce unconstitutional. And ultimately, it was this preemption doctrine that created the marble cake. Because now, what is a state?
State has no sovereignty anymore. The federal government can tell it what to do in any situation if the federal government wants.
How bad did it get? Well, in 1948, the Supreme Court upheld a conviction of a pharmacist working in Buffalo who accidentally misbranded two pill boxes containing 12 tablets. So we're talking 6 and 6 pills. 12 pills. That's it. He didn't put a label on there as was required by the FDA warning that the pills could be harmful if not used properly. He was fined thousands of dollars. He lost his pharmaceutical license and was forced to serve, I think, 3 months probation. Went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, that law's fine. He deserved to be punished because he violated federal law, because he forgot to put a effing sticker on two boxes. If there is no delineation, the original intent of our founding fathers of checks and balances essentially goes away. Because now the federal government can do whatever it wants. And how bad did it get? Well, this is the worst example that I can give you. Wickard v. Hillborn. Learn about this case in law school. During the Great Depression,
the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration passed quotas on agricultural production. If you were a farmer and you owned your land and you produced crops, the federal government came in and told you exactly how much you could produce.
Well, unfortunately, poor Mr. Wickard was a farmer. I think he was in Illinois, might have been Indiana.
He had a big farm. And Once the law was passed, he immediately complied because he was a patriot. I think he was only allowed to plant something like 70 acres of his 500-acre farm. You could plant your 70 acres and you could sell the crops off those 70 acres. Well, the problem is the government was also controlling the prices. So even though he was following the law, the federal government's restrictions were basically making it difficult for him to make ends meet. So what he decided to do, because he had so much land, is he would continue to plant and farm those 70 acres as allowed by the law, but he'd make a side field in which he would plant crops to feed his livestock. So he wasn't trying to sell extra. He wasn't going to put his crops on the black market. He just needed extra grain and hay to feed his horses and his cows and his sheep.
Is that initial quota, was that grouped in with what was expected to feed people's livestock?
You only could plant 70.
Like that, just like no.
That's what the law said.
Okay.
But the issue of could you use that or do you have to sell that, that was never addressed until this case.
Okay.
So, one of the local agricultural administrators found out, went to his farm, and he got fined $500 in 1940s Great Depression money. Big money. Didn't have the money to pay. So he sues. Goes into federal court, because it's a federal law, and he actually wins. The federal court said, yeah, this is ridiculous. You're planting 5 extra acres, you're not selling it, you're just consuming it internally. Well, the federal government was not happy about this, so they appeal it. Gets up to the appeals court, and the farmer wins again, which infuriated the administration. So they appeal it up into the New Deal court. It gets up there, and in an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court held that his planting those few extra acres to feed his livestock was sufficiently interfering with interstate commerce. You know why? Because he was growing his own food instead of buying the food for his livestock. So he had a detrimental effect on the economy. Because instead of paying someone, he was producing it himself.
That sounds like commie gobbledygook.
This ruling is still precedent today. So the federal government can actually come in and punish you if you have a backyard garden. You're not allowed to grow your own crops.
Anywhere.
You have to buy food.
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
How come? So obviously that isn't enforced.
It's not enforced. But you get the wrong administration in, and could they? Oh, absolutely.
That's insane.
It is insane. Yes?
I mean, I don't know how exactly serious it was, but it kind of sounds almost identical to how Trump said it was illegal to boycott Tesla. Right?
That, I didn't see the press conference yesterday.
He said it
but
was illegal to boycott Tesla. I don't know how serious.
I believe he was referring to the person that lit the Tesla dealership on fire.
Yeah, that wouldn't be something that Trump would say. Trump is kind of a capitalist, but he's probably talking about all the activists that are out setting Tesla charging stations on fire and blowing up, you know, cyber trucks and all the rest.
That is not peaceful protest. You want to hold a sign on the corner of a dealership? That's fine. By the way, I'd support you if you wanted to do that.
Oh, yeah.
But you're going to set a dealership on fire? No, we can't be having that. All right, other questions?
So again, these are all political decisions based on the times. And generally speaking, the American people kind of sat back and accepted them. Because, do you think the government came out and fully explained the extent of Wickard v. Filburn to the American people? No. But let's not forget what I said not too long ago. One of the greatest freedoms in America you have is to be ignorant.
I have one more question.
Yes.
So, this is just the way I've understood it, but I'd like to clarify.
Sure.
The New Deal sort of rewrote the social contract.
Completely.
The people and the government.
Yep.
Whereas before it was, we gave the government power and they gave us... No.
We gave them consent to pass laws to protect our rights.
Right.
And by doing so, we've basically abandoned our ability to tell them no. So now they can basically do whatever they want.
So that was,
and they can say, oh, it's for your own good. It's for your safety.
Right. So, okay, so originally it was we had rights.
We had unalienable rights.
Right, and we elected the government to keep that the structural integrity of that system.
Correct.
Whereas after the New Deal, the social contract changed to we give the government power and they give us rights.
So we went from having civil liberties, which are God-given, to an emphasis on civil rights, which is government-given. And the danger in wanting civil rights over civil liberties is if the government can giveth,
the government can take it
the
away.
Government can take it away. So, why am I against, for example, any type of law dealing with firearms? You give them an inch, they're pushing to take it all. And then once they take away the citizens' right to defend themselves from the government, look at how that turns out, historically speaking, on a global level.
Never will.
Never will. All right. Well, soon, the marble cake, cooperative federalism, would give rise in the 1960s and early 1970s to what political scientists refer to as creative federalism, or as I love to call it, socialism light. This is the closest we came to becoming like France, the Soviet Union, Cuba, China. So what type of model am I going to give you? There you go. Because what would the federal government do, knowing that the Supreme Court would uphold every single decision? Whatever it wanted. They took control of the economy. They took control of industry. They took control of agricultural production. And once they did that, they began intruding on the realm of your liberties. Regulating human behavior itself. And they did it with the creation of what today we call the welfare state. During the Johnson administration, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and his great society, he promised the nation that he was going to use all of the powers of the federal government to focus on issues like poverty and civil rights and urban decay. Creating government assistance programs in which they would take money out of your pocket and essentially redistribute it to somebody else. But it wasn't dollar for dollar. No, 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 no. Because let's not forget the administrative costs. If the government's going to take $1 of your money from you, you know how much money actually gets out to the programs? 5 cents? This is all the stuff that Doge is exposing.
But it all began under the presidency of LBJ. And why did he do it?
Well, I've read multiple sources. But one of the ones that I'm inclined to agree with was he was also committed to fighting the Vietnam War. And the American people initially were kind of okay with the Vietnam War, but as the 60s went by, it was becoming less and less popular.
So, deep down, I think LBJ was pushing all these programs to basically
use money to have control.
Could it have had anything to do with the fact that his wife ran all the trucking into and out of Vietnam?
Yeah, but so what if they were reaping millions and millions of dollars personally? You implying that our elected officials are corrupt somehow? Man.
And JFK was wanting to end the war.
He did. He did. He was,
Until his head exploded.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And by the way, one of the interesting theories that I've recently read about, Nixon and Watergate, they did that, they created that situation, it was basically a lie, to get Nixon out because Nixon was going to fully release all the information on JFK's assassination.
That
would have been interesting.
I think that was the day America lost her
innocence. Oh, completely. Completely. Because so many people believed it. Hook, line, and sinker.
Didn't even make sense. There's nope. Gun smoke on the bridge, but he's up here somehow.
Yeah, I know.
What?
Yeah. All right, Civil Rights Act. So, using the death of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy as the rallying cry, Lyndon Baines Johnson managed to shepherd a bill through Congress that is known as the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This law would put into federal statute definitions of what discrimination is. And these laws defined it, dealing with racial, ethnic, nationality, women, what you could do and what you could not. Because if you did something that this law did not like, suddenly it's discriminatory. And the federal government would have the power under the statute to come in and punish you. But the problem is let's not forget, punishment is arbitrary. Government doesn't have to punish all incidents. Government determines what incident it's going to punish. So where do they go after? Well, they went after areas of unequal application of voter registration. They went after segregation in public schools and public facilities. They went after discrimination in workplaces. Anything that was open to the public, the federal government began intruding upon. And it based the civil rights law on the Commerce Clause. Basically arguing that if it's a business and it engages in discrimination, somehow that business is associated with interstate commerce, and thus the federal government can come in and regulate it. Well, right out of the gates, it was challenged. In a case that, again, would get all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Heart of Atlanta Motel v. U.S. All right. Now, by the way, I'm just giving you the facts. Morton Rollinson was the owner of the Heart of Atlanta Motel. And let's just say there was a certain complexion of clientele that he did not want to take money from. Now, me, being a true capitalist, the only color that I'm interested in is green. If I had a business, I would want everyone coming in and showering me in it. Because if you're in business, don't you want more green? But he decides, no, I only want green from some people. Others people green, I don't want. Thus, as a private business owner, he makes a decision for his business. Well, the federal government found out about this and fines him thousands and thousands of dollars for violating the Civil Rights Act. Well, of course, if you get fined, you can take it to court and you can defend yourself. And Rolleston argued that this law exceeds Congress's commerce power. He's running a motel. How is a motel part of interstate commerce? People come into Atlanta in the state of Georgia, pull into his parking lot, and sleeps. And then leave. He also argued that it was a violation of the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause. He is being forced by the federal government to accept customers. What happened to life, liberty, property? And he also argues, I'm laughing because this, I could not imagine being a lawyer making this argument, but he argues also that this is a violation of the 13th Amendment. Because if the federal government is forcing him to take customers, he effectively is the slave of the government. Well, the Supreme Court looked at the case, and right off the bat, they got rid of the 13th Amendment argument. Because what the court said, which I agree with completely, is that there is no government entity forcing you to own a hotel. That's your choice. If you don't want to follow the law, what can you do? Shut your business. All right. But what about the Fifth Amendment? What about the Commerce Clause? Well, it turns out his hotel was strategically located near where Route 75 and Route 85 intersect just north of Atlanta. And apparently the court discovered that 75% or so of his clientele were travelers from out of state. Thus, they were bringing their money, which was earned in other states, through interstate commerce, to give it to him. Well, the court argued that, in effect, his business is significantly impacted by interstate commerce, and that's the commerce that the federal government has the right to regulate. Thus, if the government can find any link, any connection to your business, no matter what it does, the government can regulate you. They now can tell you what you can sell, who you can sell it to, how much you must pay your employees, what level of benefits you have to give your employees. They can tell you what hours you can be open. They can tell you where you can put your business. Is that freedom? All right, when we come back, we're going to finish up federalism. We're going to see how the court began pushing back. And I'm going to warn you, I am just about done with federalism. So when federalism is over, we're going to have our second example. Oh, and on that, because the individual who did not take it is not here, they were supposed to take it on Monday. They did not. The individual's not here because I kind of read him the Riot Act via email.
basically kind of saying, you know, how it was kind of, you know, disrespectful to the rest of the group. So if the individual does not take the exam today, they're getting a zero and all the grades are lower. Because I'm done. I've been too kind and nice. And it's not fair to you. Yes?
Will the exam be next week?
What?
The exam will be next week.
It will be next week, but it just depends. So it might be Tuesday if we can get through everything on Monday.
Because I'll be away next week. The baseball team is going to Myrtle Beach.
Okay, send me an email about that because I'll give you that as an excused absence because that's a school-related function.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So what you can do is if you can't take it when you're down there, we can just figure it out time when you come back. Like,
right.
Yeah, over break or whatever.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.
Yep. All right, we'll see you.